Hi, it's Dave. Welcome to a live stream. Here I'm joined with James Dalma. He's been on my show many, many times, probably 20 episodes. We've been talking about Tesla, AI, full self-driving, and a bunch of different topics. And it's my pleasure to have a live stream. I've been dying to have a live stream with James, just field questions and talk with and hang out with people.
You just don't want to do any editing.
You know me by now. Exactly. That's one of the goals of my channel. Make it pain-free. So, James, I have like so many topics. I don't think I could fit it all in just one session here. I might have to ask you. Push it off for next week or something. But let's dive into it. I don't want to waste any time here. Did you see Dennis Hong? He's a professor at UCLA. He runs a robotics lab there. He tweeted out, it seems like, a photo of a chip. And I'm going to show it on the screen here. What do you think this chip is? Is it a Dojo?
It's a packaging technology for... it's a packaging technology for putting a bunch of chips together close and a bunch of large chips and getting heat out of the package. So it's a, you know, it's regular ICs, commercial ICs mostly, they just get potted in plastic and they get soldered down to a board. And then you have to run them at a power density that is low enough that you can get the heat out. And there are some exceptions, you know, like people who get fancy gaming PCs, or if you have a GPU, you have a chip where the chip is already pretty expensive and you really want to get everything you can out of it. So you want to crank up the clock rate, but to get it to run at a higher frequency, you have to run it at a higher voltage. The amount of current sloshing around inside the IC goes up, and so the amount of heat goes up. And then silicon only works in a fairly narrow, it only works well in a fairly narrow range of temperatures. So if you want to crank up the clock rate, and if you want to pump lots of data in and out of your chip, it gets really hot, and you have to figure out how to get the heat out. So the hottest chips, the ones that you care the most about, they typically, you know, they get big heat sinks on them in a PC. And like your laptop, you know, it'll have, you know, if it's it'll have a heat sink sitting on top of the IC and a little fan to blow air over it. And all of that is to just keep the IC at a temperature where it'll continue to operate well. So when you really want to push chips hard, you know, the thermal constraint becomes a really big deal, because not only do you have to get, you have to get power, lots of power into the chip, and you have to get lots of data in the chip, lots of data out of the chip. And then it's making all this heat, and you got to get the heat out of the chip. And getting all this stuff in and out of the, in and out of a chip is a very challenging mechanical design problem. For most consumer electronics, they pretty much punt. They just put a bigger IC in, they run it slower to keep it at a lower temperature. But if you really want to wring everything you can out of a piece of silicon, the other approach that you can go is you can go to very exotically sophisticated packaging solutions that allow you to operate the IC at extremely high power densities and get the heat out, right? So, which means you got to get a lot of metal down in close contact with the silicon. It needs to have a lot of surface area. And then you need some kind of cooling system connected to that metal so that you can pull the heat out of the metal. So this photo, to me, it looks like a package for taking 25 big pieces of silicon and putting them on a common substrate with a high bandwidth interconnect and then getting a lot of heat out of them. That's why there's all these big chunks of metal. That, that top piece of metal and that bottom piece of metal you see in that photograph, they look like heat plates to me. So basically, there's a big chunk of metal. All that stuff gets sandwiched in between these two. And then you might have, say, a coolant loop attached to a heat exchanger on top of this or something. That's what it looks like to me.
Is this normal in terms of like...
No, this is a super... This is exotically unusual for... supercomputers, once upon a time... like back in the days when Cray Seymour was designing PCs or designing supercomputers, he took an approach where it was like, you know, there was what the electronics could do at that point in time. And he and his company spent, they did a lot of exotic packaging and a lot of exotic interconnect to try to wring as much as possible out of silicon. But after, so those are vector hyperscale machines. But starting in the early 80s, big computers kind of shifted to, instead of trying to push the silicon as hard as you could, instead what they did was they went to this, let's just have tons of silicon. So the computers got really big. They got data centers, thousands of racks, and it's a different way to go. You know, if it requires you to more loosely couple all your processes so that you can slice it up into lots of separate pieces that are not too tightly coupled. And so if they have to be tightly coupled, you need a lot of bandwidth running between them. It's got to be low latency and very high bandwidth. If you can loosely couple the problem, you can break your computer up into separate racks. And the nice thing about that is a manufacturing technology, you can mass produce them using the same technology that goes into cell phones and or PCs or whatnot. And so it brings the cost per, you know, unit of compute down significantly. But if you need a if your problem is tightly coupled so that you really need to exchange data, then you basically have two choices. One is you can go to super, super big pieces of silicon. And there's a company called Cerebras, which is doing wafer scale now. Mm. They leave all the chips on the wafer. And so they have a chip that's like this big, right? And their solution for interconnect is, you know, they have this giant slab of interconnect that comes down on the top and another giant slab that goes on the bottom of essentially this humongous chip. And then the data goes in and out one side of that, and the power and heat go in and out the other side of that. And this is a different approach. The downside to doing things wafer scale is any given wafer always has a certain number of bad chips on it. So designing a computer so that you can have bad chips and it still works fine, it still works really well, is pretty challenging. So usually what we do is, you know, you design a bunch of chips on a wafer and then you dice the wafer up into pieces, into individual chips, and then you test which ones are good and you throw away the bad ones. And so when you build your computer, you're only putting good chips in it. So, you know, but the thing is to try to get some of the benefits of being wafer scale, where you can have really high bandwidth at very low power density. It's when a data signal comes off of one IC and goes on to another IC, it has to pass through some medium, which is not a transmission line on the silicon. And those medium are lossy because they have interconnects and you get reflections and there's, you know, narrowed spectrum that you can use for your signals. And it's more expensive. Every single wire that you run costs more and is more complicated. So generally, one approach to trying to minimize that is you can try to put the chips really, really close together and put them on some high precision substrate, which sometimes is another wafer. I mean, people do this with silicon, but usually that's some kind of PCB style substrate right now, which is patterned with very fine precision. Then you make your chip and you put you bring all the I/O connections to the top of the chip, and then you put a bunch of little metal balls on it. You flip it upside down and you stick it on a pattern of pads on this substrate. And then the substrate itself is like a very, very fine pitch printed circuit board, and it can interconnect all these chips. So as big as you can make that substrate, you can almost get, it's not quite the same as if everything stays on the piece of silicon, but you can pick and choose the pieces of the wafer you want and then mix and match them, put them down on this you know, PCB style interconnect substrate. And so that's a pretty popular way of doing this stuff right now. It's called a multi-chip module. Mm-hmm. And it's done a couple of different ways. But for instance, AMD has recently gone to a chiplet architecture for their high-end processors, where they take the processor itself, and instead of making it one piece of silicon, they'll make it in 4 or 8 pieces mm-hmm. of silicon, and they put them down on a substrate. And basically they get higher yield at higher performance, but their packaging technology gets more complicated. And this is just a much more extreme version of the same thing.
So, do you think this is the Dojo chip that Tesla's made?
Yeah, that was my first, this is a package. This isn't a chip, right?
Well, yeah, many chips. Yeah.
So it looks to me like there's 25 large pieces of silicon mm-hmm. on this thing.
Got it.
It could be more. The picture resolution isn't very high, mm-hmm. but yeah, it looks to me like this is broken up into a 5x5 grid of chunks of silicon with some kind of packaging. And then it's the resolution is so bad, I can't really tell, but they might have a ton of balls on the bottom, yeah. or the top surface, or that might just be a thermal interface. I mean, the top thing is definitely a spreader plate, yeah, that looks like it's designed to be connected to a big heat sink. The bottom is a chunk of extruded aluminum that actually has heat sink fins, mm-hmm, or maybe water channels.
Okay.
Baked into it.
How would you be, like, taking a step back, mm-hmm, bigger picture, comparing this to Tesla's current iteration of their supercomputer using, like, NVIDIA's, you know, high-end GPUs? Like, what's the kind of takeaway? Like, how different is this kind of approach?
This is really different.
Yeah.
This is a very different approach to building. So imagine, I mean, one way of thinking of this, right, is Tesla's got several hundred nodes. Each one of those nodes has 8 GPUs in it. Each one of those GPUs is, you know, the GPU itself is a chip that's, you know, bigger than a postage stamp. You know, it's maybe an inch across or something like that. And it sits, you know, it goes into a package. It gets put on a printed circuit board. It has a big heat sink that sits on top of it. It has all these electronics that support that chip that provide it power and I/O interconnect. It gets some local memory. So that's a card. And you put 8 of these cards in a machine that has a motherboard. And you have a couple of CPUs on that kind of stuff. And then it gets a bunch of high bandwidth interconnect, InfiniBand networking. And that all goes in a box that's big. You know, mm-hmm, it's this tall and, you know, this deep, and it weighs 100 pounds or something like that. And you can put maybe 8 of them in a rack that's about the size of a refrigerator. So that gets you, you know, 64 GPUs in something the size of a refrigerator, right? Mm-hmm. And so now this thing, if those were each GPUs, like, I mean, I don't know exactly what the scale of this, but each of those pieces of silicon is roughly, say, the same size as this is 25 of them, and it's in a box this big. And it's designed to get the heat in and out really quickly. So these things can all be much more tightly coupled. They can talk to each other much more quickly with much less power having to go in. You can run them at a much higher clock rate because now that you've built this little box, it's cost effective to build a big heat spreader stack and liquid cooler and everything that sits on top of this. So you might be able to run these twice as fast or 4 times as fast as NVIDIA can run the GPU because you can get you can invest in getting the heat out of this thing. This, at the end of the day, building stuff this way is more expensive. Like per GPU, this is going to cost more because it's custom. You don't get to like use cell phone mass produced PC electronic technologies to build your system. But what you do get is the ability to have all of your chips much more tightly coupled. And what that means is that you don't have to construct your computation in a way where the bits and pieces are more loosely coupled. It gives you a lot more freedom with the way that you structure the computation that you're doing. And that lets you choose to do it in a way that's more optimal for the silicon you have. You don't have to think as much about partitioning things to make the interconnect feasible, you know, when the boxes are a foot away from each other. Mm-hmm. You know, NVIDIA's chips are in the computer that Tesla has right now. They're literally several inches apart. Each one is several inches apart. And it's got all of this interconnect between it. And here you can look at these. These things are a millimeter apart. They're right next to each other.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, it's interesting because it seems like, you know, either this was part of the invite that Dennis Hong got or somehow he got it elsewhere. But it seems like this would be a decent chunk of the talk, maybe a good 30 to 45 minutes probably at AI Day, like, you know, them going over, you know, their strategy or approach with this, the design. What are your thoughts? Do you think this is going to be a big part of AI Day?
You know, it remains to be seen how much they talk about it. I was on the Tesla Autopilot Day. I was incredibly happy with the level of detail that they went into. I feel like they showed us a ton about the product that they're making. We didn't see as much behind the curtain of like what happens in the back room, but they were, it felt to me quite forthcoming about the nature of the stuff they were doing. Now, of course, at Autonomy Day, they were basic. My sense is that the point of the effort of Autonomy Day, I mean, that was recruiting also, but on top of that, they were making a pitch to change the perception that that Tesla was not capable of executing in this space, you know, by basically showing ways that they were out executing everybody else, right? I mean, they may not be out executing everybody and everything, but they definitely showed some ways that they're out executing anybody else, and they're out investing and they're out committing other entities in the space, that they're very serious about this. Elon has said that the point of AI Day is going to be pretty purely recruitment. And maybe it is, or maybe it ends up being a lot like Autonomy Day, in that it's also kind of, in some sense, a pitch to convey to the public the sense that Tesla's actually, you know, serious about this. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they still see value in that. But, you know, as an engineer, I look at something like this and I get pretty excited. This isn't something that you get to... No, it's nuts. I mean, I used to design high-speed interconnect, and like, there are these little black columns. So in this layer cake, right, on the very bottom, there's an aluminum heat spreader. And the next layer up above that, there's a printed circuit board. And there are these little black columns. There's two of them for each one of those 25 chips on the top layer. And when I zoom in on those things, I see what look like micro balls. Which makes me think that this is a vertical, this is a high-speed vertical interconnect, a high-speed, extremely high bandwidth vertical interconnect between two PCBs that goes through this intervening heat spreader. And I've never seen anything like that. In fact, after I saw this photo, I went looking to see, like who did this, right? Like, is this a commercial product that you can buy? Because I would have loved, like back when I was designing gigabit transceivers, I would have loved to see interconnect like this. This is, if it's what I think it is, it's really next level stuff. Like, I don't know who's doing this. But so, you know, to somebody who's interested in working on this kind of tech, you look at this kind of thing and you're like, wow, I want to do that. I want to use that, right? Who is it? Pete Bannon said something about how when he had people coming up to him early, you know, when Tesla was doing recruiting stuff, when they were explaining to people on under NDA what they had in the back, the silicon, that an ML practitioner had said to him, you know, people will come work at Tesla just because they want to be able to use that chip, right? Just because they want to work on that chip because it's really cool. And I can vouch for that. You know, that FSD silicon that they make is super exciting. And showing that and talking about what it is and how real it is and what you can do with it is a way to get the kind of people you really want on your team excited about signing up and coming in. So this, you know, for people who are doing HPC architectures, this could be very much like that. It's very different from what anybody else is doing right now in this space.
Marty Party 03 on the live stream says alien technology. Fun stuff.
Well, the thing I said about the, you know, the carbon overwrap rotors, like that is so cool. That is so cool. The idea that you wrap carbon around a slab of metal so that you can maintain the geometric tolerances on the thing as you spin it up to these ungodly high accelerations. It's just really, really cool. You know, to me, that's cooler than a Raptor engine.
Yeah. We have Marty Party also says, how does Dennis Hong fit into the AI Day picture? So Dennis Hong is a professor at UCLA. He runs the Robotics and Mechanisms Lab. Seems like he's under NDA, according to some of his tweets with Tesla, and he's invited to Tesla AI Day. What do you think? Do you think there's some type of partnership with his robotics lab?
So I haven't looked closely at what his robotics lab does. I did look quickly to see what papers he had done recently. I haven't looked at what his lab has produced. And everything I could find was fairly generically robotics related. But, you know, that said, you know, robotics, one of the things that differentiates it from regular AI is that it frequently has a lot of mechanical design involved in it, a lot of clever mechanical design. And, this basically is mechanical design that we're looking at here. It's electromechanical, but well, it's actually not electromechanical. It's electronics and mechanical packaging. But, you know, so it's not the kind of the core capabilities that a robotics lab has on the mechanical designed end could be applicable to doing this. Yeah, I found it really weird that he was the guy that was tweeting this out too, because it's not what I expect from a robotics lab. It's what I expect from like an HPC lab. But it's not like they can't do it.
I think people misunderstood that tweet. People thought, you know, he has something to do with the chip. And I looked at more like he got an invite from Tesla, and the invite had that. That's the picture of the invite.
Yeah.
So he just is tweeting out the invite that he got. I don't think he has anything to do with the actual chip design, right? I think he's just tweeting out the invite. But it turns out he got invited early, or one of the first, because I think his robotics lab has inked a robotics partnership with Tesla to, you know, where, you know, they're sharing kind of robotics tech, and Tesla's maybe sharing
So he's AI. He was at the DARPA Urban Challenge on one of the teams there, and he's done self-driving car stuff too.
Yeah, but it seems like the past 10 years he's shifted more to robotics, from what I've seen. It's going to be interesting. I think, I don't know. I was kind of doing some diving into his projects, and he talks about this thing called RoboCup. Have you heard of this thing? It's where where they're trying to get robots to eventually beat humans at soccer. And right now they're just doing robot to robot. And I'm watching these videos of these robots playing soccer, falling over, trying to get up, like walking a little bit.
No, it's an interesting problem, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's an interesting toy problem that involves a lot. You know, to basically do well in RoboCup, you have to solve a subset of the things that that robots in the real world have to do.
Exactly.
It's a competition, you know, people get excited about it. You know, you get your little teams of robots out running around on a field, kicking a ball around. Everybody can understand it. It's a pretty brilliant concept for getting people into it.
Yeah. It seems like, you know, Tesla's kind of real world AI experience probably can be applied a lot to RoboCup. You know, if you combine Tesla's AI experience plus perhaps, you know, this UCLA lab robotics together, I'm sure that their lab can like make their robots, the soccer robots, more contextually aware, you know, process, you know, what's going on, better, faster, quicker. And as long as they're able to speed up, you know, how fast the robots move and interact and stuff, it seems like eventually they would have a tremendous edge, you know, against other teams if they partner with Tesla, you know, in terms of Tesla getting, you know, giving some of the AI kind of tools, compute power, you know, expertise.
But, you know, Tesla wants to hire their people away, right?
Yeah. Eventually, I mean, that's
like
the thing.
That's the goal.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Tesla needs, you know, and it's actually beneficial in some way for the lab, because it's like makes it more prestigious, right? Because they're working with now Tesla. And then the people get hired by Tesla, but I mean, it's mutually beneficial, it seems like, you know? I mean, this is going to raise the profile of that lab a lot, it seems like.
Could be.
Yeah.
Elon's got what, like 100 million Twitter followers, you know?
Yeah, it's Dennis Hong's Twitter profile. I think it was like under 2,000 this morning. It's like up to 4,000 to 5,000 just within a few hours. Yeah, it's kind of crazy. Tesla community is going to have to look into all this stuff. I want to take a step back into kind of full self-driving. We had this big update, 9.1. I haven't talked to you publicly on my YouTube channel since 9.0 got released, but we actually met in Corona, California. We rode the car for like 3 hours. And then, you know, I had a chance to ride it about 4 or 5 hours, the 9.1 version, just this past few days. But in your experience, just with 9.0 and also maybe videos, I've sent you some videos also with 9.1, but with your experience, what's going on here with Tesla? How do you see 9.0? Is it... are you noticing, you know, differences from its previous versions? How is it evolving? Are there any kind of big areas you think need improvement, or areas that they are already improving a lot? Kind of what's your overview on kind of 9.0 and 9.1?
I didn't have 8 and I don't have 9, and I've only spent a couple hours. I spent, you know, a few hours with you in 9, and I think I've spent a couple hours in 8. And, so I don't feel like I have the kind of experience base to be able to say broad, general things about how the, you know, the experience of driving them. I've watched a decent number of the videos. People's experience on 8 and on 9, they vary a lot. There are people who definitely struggle, and there are people who are absolutely delighted with it, and they feel like it's working great. And some of this is undoubtedly because people have different expectations and comfort zones with respect to what, you know, the car can do when they're driving it. But also a lot of it has to do with just like the characteristics of the place that they happen to do their driving or the kind of driving they do.
Yeah.
You know, if you have a left turn across high speed traffic into the community you live in, and that's a thing you drive every single day, and it doesn't do that well, you know, and you're using FSD when you're coming home late at work, you know, and there's a ton of traffic and you're thinking the car might kill you. Yeah, you're going to have a different experience than somebody who like only uses it on vacation and spends a lot of time on empty roads and the highway. Or if you're a night owl, you know, and you use it at night and that kind of stuff. Right. But, you know, it's not done for sure. Mm-hmm. It definitely has a lot of ugly spots to it. But I think I said to you at one time, I can't remember if it was on a video or in person, that it's actually, it's not bad compared to what Autopilot was like when Autopilot first rolled out. I mean, Autopilot was pretty scary and you really had to watch it. And I was actually surprised at the level of polish when, you know, the first 8.0 videos I saw coming out. You know, it wasn't trying to kill people that much. You know? I mean, it looked to me like, you know, it was, that it was pretty passable. Of course, you know, on the highway, you can't run stop signs and you don't have to worry about missing lights. And, you know, there isn't much cross traffic on highways and that kind of stuff. So in a sense, it's a safer environment. So I can see why they would want to be more conservative and be, you know, wait until it's more polished before they push FSD out, compared to what they were willing to do when they pushed AP out. And they may have gotten more conservative because, you know, they did have a couple of bad accidents on AP in the first couple of years. And that's got to be a really painful thing for the development team, right?
Yeah.
To experience.
I mean, I think one of the challenges is it's really difficult to evaluate FSD and the progress in a lot of ways, because a lot of times you don't know exactly why it's doing what it's doing. Like, actually talking with you when we met in Corona about 3 weeks ago or so, that was super helpful, because just that one insight you shared about how they could dial down the kind of aggressive level if they want to, with a big new release, just to be extra careful. And if they did that, it could kind of make it seem like it's not as safe, or because it's more hesitant, you know, but it's something they could easily just dial up. But there's like pros and cons to certain things where it might not be. And so after talking with you, like, I've been kind of looking at, you know, the visualization a lot. I'm like, okay, is this a visualization problem where it's tracking some type of visualization thing?
Perception?
Yeah, perception, yeah. Okay. Or is this more of a planning problem where it actually has the, you know, perception correct? It's just planning-wise, there's some type of, you know, maybe inefficiency or inaccuracy, et cetera. And that's helpful too, because it kind of shows me, it's like, oh, okay, I think they're not prioritizing the planning maybe as much as the perception right now. I mean, is that your take right now? Like, they're really wanting to nail the vision first before, let's say, making the planning, the driving feel more human. Like, you know, they're it seems like they're really trying to, with their big shift over from radar to, you know, and the whole bird's eye view and also pseudo kind of radar, LIDAR, all this stuff is like they're making big inroads into perception, accurately kind of understanding the world around. It seems like once they have that, they can incrementally and increasingly focus on more on the planning side and actually being able to navigate the situations more, I wouldn't say confidently, but it feels to the human like it's, you know, more smooth and confident. What's your take kind of on what you think maybe the priority Tesla has right now? Is it on perception, or do you think the planning is as important and they're like really focused on that right now too?
So planning is critically dependent on perception. So to some extent, there's, if your perception isn't working, I'm getting an interesting kind of audio scraping kind of sound from you. I wonder if you might be on this microphone instead of that microphone right now.
Let me go ahead and check. Actually, maybe it's my pen. I'll stop. Yeah, moving anything.
Okay. Just FYI.
Yeah.
The way that I heard what you were saying is that you felt like they had priorities in terms of what they thought was important. And I would sort of, I look at it from the standpoint of somebody who's like trying to solve an engineering problem. Right. And so if you have, you know, system A and system B, and B is very dependent on A and A isn't very dependent on B, you get more bang for the buck solving the bugs in A, because if you're trying to solve a bug in B, you may end up finding it's actually, it's getting something bad from A instead. So like focusing on B is a block. So if B is planning and A is perception, to some extent, there are a lot of planning problems that you just can't do a good job on until your perception gets to a certain level. So it's not so much that perception is more important. It's kind of more fundamental, right? And you want it to, so you might find that you're focusing more on perception because it's more of a source of problems for the whole system at a particular point in time. It may also be that Tesla has, that they can decompose the problem and they can look at what the dependencies are and make decisions on the basis of those dependencies about where they get the most bang for the buck in terms of like trying to solve problems. But they also have, Tesla's goal is not to ship the best possible FSD next week or 2 months from now. It's to solve the full self-driving problem. And as soon as possible, I presume, you know, safely ship something that can do the robo-taxi job, that can do the real FSD job. So if shipping something that's better next week actually causes the long-term goal to slip out, then they wouldn't do that, right? They might, and there are definitely situations where you choose not to ship something that looks as good right now as you could, because if you do that, you're going to be pushing the long-term goal out. And one example of how that happens is you want to find the problems. So if you put a bunch of safety harnesses on your system that mask problems that you are having, then you're not seeing the problems, right? But you also haven't fixed them. You're just hiding them. You don't want to just make the symptom go away. You want to find the, you want to fix the problem, and to fix the problem, you got to find the problem. To find the problem, you got to see the problem, right? So there are things that you don't want to do when you're testing because they masquerade your problem. And in fact, it's almost kind of the opposite. If you're a tester working at a software company, right, and you work in the test group, they don't have you, you know, work on the parts of the program that work well. They have you spend all your time on things where they know they have problems, right? They want to expose that. Yeah. So from a testing standpoint, and I don't know to what extent the beta testers are getting the same experiences like what the team internally would get or what, you know, Elon might see when he's driving his car. But, if they're not having very many interventions, they're not doing you any good, right? You're not learning anything from somebody who like gets in the car and they drive it and they never have an intervention. They're collecting some data maybe, but they get a lot more value from somebody who has a lot of interventions. Yeah. So then you have the question of like, well, you know, if they have too many interventions, they'll stop driving the car because they're afraid of it. You know, so there's like this zone where they're getting enough interventions that you're getting data back that's useful. It helps you develop the product and understand, you know, how it's actually behaving in the wider world without any, you know, sort of things that mask the problems.
Yeah. It's one of the most, I think, misunderstood or overlooked kind of things. Like after talking with you a few weeks, I really understood. I'm like, oh wow, it's like Tesla really could make this feel more polished with less interventions or less kind of like jerky or like so-called dangerous at certain times. It could, like, for example, you're entering into a place where there's a lot of uncertainty. It just basically disengages itself, says, oh, take over earlier, right? But if Tesla does stuff like that too much, then they're not pushing the limits of where their system kind of breaks, you know, and they're not getting the most valuable, you know, information that they can. But if they want to really solve these difficult problems, you let the system kind of go to the problem, to the place where it fails, right? And then you can get more data from that, you know, failed intervention or situation. Yeah. It speeds
it is
up
a balance.
Yeah, it speeds up the process, but the end result or the impression from some of the testers, especially a lot of testers are doing lots of videos, it seems like, oh my gosh, you know, it's like it's terrible, or it's like, you know, it's failing continuously, which partly
that's
it is. You know,
it is failing.
But
that doesn't mean it couldn't be made better easily.
Exactly.
But meaning, it may not help the long term goal to take the shortcut of doing that.
Exactly.
Although there's another trade-off on that, right? Mm-hmm. So when AP2 was young, mm-hmm. and this is also a problem with AP1 pretty much throughout its thing, the lateral control algorithm, you know, they had a neural network basically deciding where to place, how much to turn the wheel based on what it saw on the lines. And it had this, periodically, it would be terrible. It would be really moving around the lane, right? And it would be moving around the lane enough that it could leave the lane. And you can't ship that out to your customers, right? So there's a quick and dirty fix that you can do where you basically look at the road type and you know from the design of, you know, I mean, basically the people who build roads, they have standards for like, for a certain speed limit, the road is only allowed to curve so much, right? So what you can do is you can go into your software and you can say, don't turn the wheel more than this, because there's a good chance that if you're turning it more than that, it's an error. Right, that you're doing something that you shouldn't be doing. And they had this, you know, turn radius as a function of speed constraint in the cars at various times. They had to turn that thing on. Now, that itself would also lead to problems. But the reason they had to put it in there was because they went through periods of time when the output that they were getting from the network, it wasn't good enough to let it control the car without any boundaries. But you don't want to make, if you tighten the boundary up too much, you're not exposing the problem, the underlying problem that you're trying to fix. So, you know, you put enough of a restriction on what the system can do so that you get reasonable safety and a reasonable experience for the people who are driving it. But you don't tighten it all the way down, because that's going to crush your ability to get the data that you need to improve the system.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, part of it is, Tesla could make it more polished or, you know, feel, you know, a lot smoother or safer, but it doesn't mean it's necessarily safer, meaning that they're, by testing the limits, they're able to get the data they need to make it ultimately safer, right? So, I mean, it's a tough one. I mean, that's why I think a lot of times, like, to evaluate FSD progress, like this is extremely challenging, because you have to understand kind of like what it's doing. Like, you know, and this is one of the things, like, I value your feedback a lot when I send you some clips and you kind of map out, you know, some of the details. I'm like, oh my gosh, yeah, I would never have caught that, you know, like a car across the median kind of going quickly to your side, but it's being an illusion of two cameras, like maybe switching positions, because as you're going forward, you know, it relies on the other camera. I'm like, oh yeah, it's like, it totally makes sense. But
yeah, that the pillar and the repeater camera, mm-hmm. they actually don't overlap, right? So this is, I don't know if this is an oversight. Like, almost the car has almost complete binocular 360 degree. Like, most places that something can be outside the car, mm-hmm. the car actually has two different cameras that can see it. So those two cameras have a significant overlapping field. So if you have your camera fusion layer, it gets to look at overlapping fields on two different cameras to get a sense of how those cameras line up. So when something transitions from one camera to the other, there's a transition zone. You don't have a sudden, but the pillar in the B camera, like directly to the left and right of the car, there's a zone where there's no camera overlap, right? So when something transitions from, you know, when you're passing something on the left or the right, and it's passing from the pillar to the from the pillar's field of view to the repeater's field of view, or vice versa, that's probably a much harder thing to get right. And it's something I've consistently seen the system have problems with. essentially objects transitioning to just to the lateral side of the car have that. I think, you know, in retrospect, I hate to over second guess things, but it seems like, you know, if they'd had some overlap in the fields of view of those two cameras, it would have made the camera fusion problem better. And there would be less of this kind of jerky mismatch stuff that happens when you move between those two fields of view.
Yeah, definitely. I think they've probably learned a lot since 2017.
Like some of the ugliest problems I see in autopilot, I drive autopilot on the highway a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think I might have 100,000 miles I've driven it now. And it's always had this problem where vehicles transitioning by, or vehicles that spend a lot of time occupying the field of view of both of those cameras, you can see that the system really has difficulty judging the nature and location of those vehicles as they make that camera transition. And the classic one is when you've got a big truck next to you. Like big trucks, it's really hard to judge, just in objective sense, a big truck. Like when a human being is in a car and you're driving a car, you don't look straight out the side of the car at the side of the giant truck and judge the distance to it, because you can't. It's really hard. You look forward to the front of it, and you look at where its wheels are relative to the lane it's driving in or whatnot. You look for those markers because you can tell with great accuracy where that truck is in its lane by looking at its tire and where it is relative to line, or the nose of the vehicle and where it is relative to your, how you judge the center. But if you look at the flat side of the vehicle, you can't see it. So autopilot needs to do that trick also, because the cameras on the side, they just see this big flat panel, right? It's impossible to judge the distance to it.
Yeah.
So, in fact, it's impossible to even do things like judge whether you're at the boundary between trucks and stuff like that when the cameras are trying to make separate decisions. One of the big improvements in the system when they went to bird's eye view and camera fusion is that the inter-camera confusion about whether you're seeing the same object or not is greatly reduced. Like, we almost never see that. And on the conventional AP, it's a huge problem.
All right.
Yes.
I want to dive into a few kind of specific cases. Have you seen Chuck Cook's YouTube channel? He has this one kind of unprotected left that he has a hard time, and then he does this loop, right? It takes him a loop and he can't do it again, and he loops. Like, my understanding when I watched that video, I'm like, if he were to press the accelerator, right, I would imagine that you would make the left turn. It's just that maybe it's being extra cautious or something. I don't know. What's your take? Is FSE going to be able to solve that left turn, or, and if so, how?
Oh, yeah, it'll be able to solve it eventually. Mm-hmm. Perception will eventually get to the point where, I mean, as a human being, you come up to the intersection, you look down, you wait for a slot that you can trust to come. So he, like, I don't know what traffic is usually like, but it looks to me like there's a place in the median where he can stop. Mm-hmm. So he can break the problem down into two pieces and do the first half and the second half. I think a lot of humans probably do that in that situation, because it looks like it's a very fairly high speed.
That's true.
Road, right? Yeah, and so judging distant high-speed traffic from two directions at the same time to find a window, especially when one's on the other side of a median and you don't know whether a car on the far, there's three lanes on the far side, is the car that you see in the first lane, second lane, or third lane? You know, all that stuff is important to being able to make the left turn. So being able to break it down is kind of nice. But eventually the car is going to have the perception to match what a human being can do in that situation, which is, you know, look to the left, look to the right, get a general sense of the situation, then look to the left and get a precisely identify the slot that you want to go into, mm-hmm. and make sure you understand how the shape of that slot is changing. Like, mm-hmm. is one of those cars going really fast and he's going to close the gap before I get, you need to make all those judgments. Then you wait for the slot to meet you, and then you go fast across
into the middle kind of spot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the thing is, you've got to gun it, right? And gun it is confidence, and it's making a big commitment. And once you gun it, all of a sudden your window of opportunities goes way down. Like, if you misjudged it, you know, you're in a very bad situation once you hit the accelerator really hard that you're going to do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think at the stage that FSD is at right now, Tesla doesn't want the car to be making those kinds of commitments. Mm-hmm. Instead, it's got the car coming to that. And it's not, it may be good enough. The thing is, until they know it's good enough, until they've seen it do that a lot in the real world, I think they don't want to let the car do that, because because if you get it wrong, it's really bad. So, yeah. So Chuck is basically doing a complicated maneuver in what I think from a drive planning standpoint is a high stakes, gamble. And so I think the driving policy is very likely going into that situation saying, I'm only going to make this left turn if it's really wide open, right? Exactly. If I've got tons of margin, if there's not much margin, I'm not going to do it. And then, so now you have the thing, well, how long do you wait to do that kind of stuff? And eventually, you know, if you were writing, this is going to be heuristic. This isn't the neural network deciding this, right? Somebody wrote the code out that says basically, I waited this long. I crept forward this many times. Okay, I'm going to give up now. And I'm going to do, well, what else can I do? If you can't turn left and you must proceed, you have to go right, right? So at some point it bails out and it goes to the right. And the stochastic sample of like, where are the cars and what time of day is it? Is going to make the determination about whether that set of logic that they've built into the planner to try to make sure that at the worst case, it doesn't put the user into a really life-threatening situation.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting about this Chuck Cook left turn situation is just because it doesn't make the turn, it doesn't mean, like what you're saying, it doesn't mean that it's incapable perhaps of making that turn. It could be also that there's this level where it needs that right now at the stage of development, they're requiring this extra safety of margin where, we don't know exactly the full capabilities,
they
right?
They just did a major rewrite of the distance determining code by taking the radar out, right?
Exactly.
It's like, so you're, if you're the engineer on that thing and you're going to push that thing out and you're like, oh, we have these 18 newbies, we're going to let them go drive the car. Where do you want to say the safety level, right? Yeah. You're very likely to go, yeah, you know, I think on the first one out, we'll turn that way down. And if it doesn't look good, just have it turn right, you know, because that's the safe failure mode for the thing. And so, he gets a funny video of it going around the block again and again.
I mean, my feeling,
an interaction between the navigation, I don't know. An interesting question is how is Tesla injecting navigation into the planning? Right. Because there are a lot of different ways that you could do that. In fact, you probably want to do it a couple of different ways. But one of the errors that you had, I thought was really interesting. It suggested that the planning, that the navigation is actually getting. So, you know, there's that vector that comes out of the car that you can see on the screen. And I think Tesla doesn't have a label for that vector and they don't tell us exactly what it is. But my best guess is it's the neural network's hunch, not including navigation data, right? It's the neural network is looking at this, choosing, it has a couple of different probabilistic paths that it has selected, which are candidates for where the car could go forward. And the one that it shows you, the one that actually gets drawn on the screen, is the one that has the highest probability. So if you're in a situation where there's really only one thing to do, that's pretty stable. But if you're in a situation where there are two things and it's kind of a toss-up, then from frame to frame, what is the best choice might flip back and forth. And so you see that path vector sort of flipping around. It's moving around. So in Chuck's case, like he comes up to the light and the path vector is going left and then it goes right. And then it goes left and then it goes right. Right. And I think that's just the neural network basically saying, this is a candidate. This is the best candidate. No, that's the best candidate. No, this is the best candidate. But at some point, the navigation data has to come in this because to get where you're going, you want to turn left.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't think that vector is including navigation data in general. I mean, the car is positioning itself and it's just basically looking at the scene. But in a sense, that vector, having it just be the path vector output from the neural network in a lot of ways is a lot more useful because if what they drew was just what was on the nav system, well, you've got that on the map already. Yeah. That's just redundant, right? So the map is telling you, well, this is where the car ideally would go, all other things being equal, to be on the most efficient route.
Yeah.
But anytime the neural network gets to that intersection, if the neural network decides it can't safely do that drive, it's not going to do that turn.
Yeah.
And if it only has one other choice, well, it has to do that. And if it does that other one, well, the nav system will reroute. You know, it'll figure it out. And occasionally you'll get a weird thing like Chuck found where it routes you back to the same intersection and you have to do it again, right? Yeah. Because that'll be a short thing. Now, all these things are easy to fix, right? Like if that was a problem, if that was the last problem that was preventing you from shipping Autopilot, you'd have some guy sit in there and write some extra heuristics to make sure the next route you calculate wasn't the last one.
Sure.
And if it was, you get rid of that one and you have it pick a different one. Or maybe you make the U-turns work.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly.
because they don't work right now.
Yeah, U-turns.
So. But if they had help. U-turns working, then failing right and doing a U-turn somewhere down the street, that would be a much more reasonable failure mode. But right now they don't have U-turns working. Yeah. And the left turn, it doesn't seem like they're comfortable enough with it to let it. And the U-turn failure is probably a subset of the left turn failure, right? In that they don't want users discovering where the boundaries are in those situations, right? It's still a little bit too risky. But as they get more and more confidence, they can gradually reduce the constraints on the system, right? You open them up a little and you see, you know, how is it working for people? What do the failure modes look like? Exactly. You open it a little more. Okay, still looks okay. You open it up a little more. And so maybe that's the way you do it. You keep cranking it open a little more and more until you're either confident or you've found an important fundamental problem that you need to address. And if you do find the important fundamental problem, the first thing you do is you close the window back down. You go in the back room and you fix the problem.
Exactly.
You test it. You ship it back out. And then you start opening the window back up again. Yeah. And this is what we experience. And it's not just with the left turn. You know, there's 20, 50 other different kinds of maneuvers like that where they're doing this all the time. Like it's failing this scenario. You know, we're going to give it a little bit more rope. And if it doesn't hang itself, we're going to keep going. And if it starts looking bad, you know, we're going to change tactic. We're going to crank it back in and then we're going to just do it again. So the left turn thing is happening simultaneously on 100 different things simultaneously. Yeah. So any given push that you get looks like a mixed bag. You know, one guy's pet peeve got a lot better and some other guy's pet peeve just got really a lot worse, right?
Yeah.
So it's always going to be a mixed bag. But if they're making progress, you look back over 3 or 4 releases and you see a trend line. And that's what matters.
Yeah.
It's not what you see on any given Carpathy, he doesn't ever want to see regression. He thinks it's really bad. That is to have the features getting worse. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a reality of development that this kind of development, that occasionally you have to regress the feature because you can't keep going in the direction that you're going. You need to find a different approach to solving it.
Yeah, with the Chuck Cook situation, I mean, a lot of people are like, oh, it's not seen far enough. We need additional cameras. But then when I think about it, it's like, you know, it doesn't seem like that's the fundamental problem. You know, it seems like the car has, you know, cameras 360, is able to see. It just seems like a solvable problem, you know, with their current hardware. What's your kind of take on that?
More hardware would be a crutch, right? Mm-hmm. In the long run, once you've solved the problem, the extra hardware wouldn't be helping you. And if you put extra hardware on the car to solve a problem, what you're doing is you're allowing your software to be worse. And sometimes that's the right choice because maybe otherwise, the thing your software has to do is so hard, it's too far away. But if all it's doing is basically allowing you to do some trick 6 months sooner, but you're adding, you're introducing complexity. As you know, we talked about radar versus vision, and radar versus vision is an interesting case for fusion, for sensor fusion, like getting the two to match up, especially the kind of radar that Tesla had and the kind of vision that Tesla has. You know, you get these interesting kind of corner cases where they both fail simultaneously spectacularly, and it's hard to work around that unless you make the vision so good that it doesn't need the radar anymore. But just fusing multiple cameras is also, you know, it's 16 cameras isn't better than 8 cameras, right? If 8 cameras can do the job, 8 cameras is the right solution. You know, it's the more parts you have, the more parts you have to fail.
Mm-hmm. Here, Dave Mack, I believe he's a beta tester too. He says in the live comments, I think the looping scenario is map based because I had the opposite occur forever. The map was wrong and it wanted to do a long loop back to the same intersection. However, it gets there and takes the overlapping route shortcut, which is not what nav showed.
Interesting.
Not sure what that means, but.
Well, you had just recently you sent me that failure where the GPS was off by 100 feet.
Yeah.
And that really showed the interaction between the nav in a really interesting kind of way, because you're driving down the road and nav is kind of a standalone system. It's like, here's my destination. Here's where I am right now. Calculate a route. If I'm not on that route for a certain amount of time, like if I get too far off that route, recalculate it, right? And it just sits in a loop and it does that. And it's not really paying any attention to what autopilot is doing, because it behaves just the same if the human drives it. If you had been driving down that road and you calculated your route and autopilot hadn't been driving, you would have seen the nav do all the same wonky stuff that you saw. It kept trying to route you out of a parking lot that you weren't in onto the street or via U-turns or whatever. But the thing with autopilot is at some point it's getting that nav input as a, you know, of the options that you have right now, choose the one that matches the map, right? Every time you come to a place that you can turn, if at least one of your decent possibilities is the one that matches the map, take that one. Otherwise, take the second best or third best or whatever. Yeah,
exactly.
And you were driving along and it was just having to guess over and over again because the GPS was off, right? Yeah. It was really acute failure mode. But yeah, so right now nav is ignoring it doesn't care whether you're in autopilot or not. It just recalculates the route. And they pretty clearly are not designing autopilot in a way that it is aware of the limitations of the nav system. It's just trying to drive the car. So you can get these feedback loops that basically Tesla doesn't care to fix yet, because when autopilot is working well, the feedback loop won't matter because the mm-hmm. failure modes will be too rare.
Mm-hmm. Did you see Galley's video? He had two videos on this
monorail.
Yeah, that whole pillar right in the middle that mm-hmm. like Tesla was the car was trying to go into a bit. What's your take on that? Was it just what was the kind of the cause of that?
That the monorail pillar that in Seattle, that lane that has the monorail pillars in it. If you look at any isolated chunk of it, it looks like a lane, right? So the car's driving down that and it's looking at it and it's seeing a lane. And I think the car has a constraint right now that when you do a lane change, you only do one lane at a time. But at the monorail pillar, you have to do two. So you've got this collision between the car's wanting to do that, what it sees as a lane change in that situation. But there's this heuristic that says you can only do one lane change at a time. But in that pillar situation, it's one where you cannot do a single lane change. You have to do two. It's not safe to do one. Right. So it just fails. Yeah. And I think it's another one of those outlier cases. The Tesla probably just doesn't care to fix right now because they got bigger fish to fry.
Yeah.
Somewhere down the road when the fundamental perception stuff is significantly better, they can slap a map hack in, right? Mm-hmm. They can they can go into the map and say, never ever get in this lane. That's stupid. Mm-hmm. Or they can add an output feature to the neural network, which I think it doesn't have right now, which is, this is a lane that you cannot drive in, right? I don't think it has undrivable lanes right now. That if you look at the, who was it? I forget, one of Green's associates went back and Tristan went back and he drove that because he lives in Seattle.
Okay.
And he pulled out the drivable space map and overlaid it on that thing. And you could see the autopilot was treating that lane with the pillars in it as drivable space, and it shouldn't be drivable space. Yeah. So one fix they could do is they could decide that they're going to train on lanes that have obstacles in them and omit them from the drivable space map. But it's not something that they've done yet.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I think Galley's in Italy, so he's not able to test it with 9.1. I think he's there for a couple more weeks. Too bad.
I would guess that is not high on the list of things that they need to fix right
now. I mean, it was a high-profile video, though, so maybe they did kind of, tweak that area.
Galley's got a big audience. It's funny. Somebody sent me a link to that video and I watched it. It's a pretty long video.
Yeah.
And of course, it's got this weird monorail pillar behavior and I looked at the monorail pillar and I thought like that was the least interesting thing in the whole video because it's such an outlier.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, if we're talking about a commercial product that's shipping to millions of people, well, that's really important. But if we're talking about something that's going out to 20 testers, who cares about that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I was looking at its performance on all the other stuff because he was driving in traffic around Seattle, all these, and the optical conditions weren't very good. And I, I was looking at it going, man, God, it's really good. It's really doing great on this video.
I think the
public reaction of the video was, oh my God, the Mario Billiard.
I think though the issue is in order to go to wide release, because once it goes to wide beta release, you're going to have a lot of people trying it out. And if there's even just a few of these like kind of crazy cases where people do crash, then that's not good. I mean, Tesla needs to, minimize that.
That's another, so there's always this perpetual tension between, do we slow down the development of this product in order to avoid the real idiots doing something really stupid? Like if you're driving the car, keep your hands on the wheel. Like I watch your video with George Hotz, and I've seen this from a lot of people. There are people who seem to think that like taking your hands off the car should be doing what it can so you can take your hands off the steering wheel. And when I think about the difference in reaction time between someone who's got their hands off the steering wheel and someone who's got their hands on the steering wheel, I'm like, keep your hands on the wheel. If you can't keep your hands on the wheel, don't use it, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's not done and you need to be safe. It really is a beta product.
Yeah.
And so, that's a trade-off between the two. So in a sense, if what we really cared about was safety, we would never, ever let people take their hands off the wheel, right? You have to have this trade-off between those two. Like there's a certain amount of risk that you accept so that you can keep the system moving forward. And then there are other risks that you don't accept for other reasons. And, taking your hands off the wheel is a completely user convenience based risk increase to the design of the system, I would argue, right?
Yeah.
Apparently, George feels differently about it. But I think taking your hands off the steering wheel is stupid. I was actually really annoyed in that video that Gally kept taking his hands off the wheel. It was really distracting. You're like, keep your hands on the wheel, man. It looks like there are cars all around you.
I mean, seriously, that was some of my adjustment period where I had to realize like this needs to be supervised at all times, this is a beta build for testers and it can be aggressively wrong at certain times, definitely. Interesting.
I mean, just keeping a tight grip on the steering wheel is actually a really good safety feature for, for like FSD in the street. If it decides it suddenly wants to turn, like when you're driving down a long straight stretch of road and you know that the steering wheel shouldn't turn suddenly to the left or suddenly to the right, you keep a tight grip on the wheel. And if the car decides to do something stupid, it automatically disengages, right? Because your grip on the wheel just breaks it right at that point. And that's like a instant 10 millisecond, response. Like you as a human are proactively, like before anything can go wrong, you're saying, this is a limit I'm not going to let you go outside of. And you can do that. And if you take your hands off the steering wheel, that's an option you don't have.
Yeah, I think so.
You can't override it in less than maybe 300, 400 milliseconds if you take your hand, maybe 700 milliseconds.
Yeah.
And there are situations where you don't want that.
Yeah, exactly. On the topic of undrivable lanes, so I was driving this one street and this second lane had these like, it was a crossed out lane and it had these diagonal lines, noting that it's crossed out. But FSD thought this was a real lane and kept on trying to get me over to that lane because I needed to turn right. But it's one of those things like, I'm not sure if they have kind of the undrivable lane, if it's detecting it a lane, or not.
I forget what those gore zone, that's called a gore zone. Okay. So when you have a delineated space on a paved surface in the United States, they're typically painted with diagonal hash marks. That's called a gore zone, and you're not supposed to go into it, even though you could drive in it. Yeah. And the car is supposed to detect that. So there's two categories of undrivable space that the car has to identify. One of them is it's really undrivable. Like that's a wall. That's really absolutely undrivable. Never, ever go there. And then there's another one which is you're not supposed to drive here, but if you have to, you can. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes, if you're in a parking lot, you have to, sometimes you're forced to maneuver across a gore zone, but it's safe. It's a clear space. Nobody's moving very fast. So gore spaces are kind of in this intermediate zone. They're not absolute, no go zones. They're in a middle space that it shouldn't go. But of course on highways traveling at high speed, sometimes it really are no go zones. And I don't think Tesla right now has a no, this is a gore zone, but you need to treat it like it really is a median zone right now.
Yeah,
got it. So maybe at some point they have to do that.
Yeah, yeah, it definitely makes sense. I want to ask about George Hotz. Were you able to watch that interview that we did?
Yeah, I watched. I finished. It took me a while to get through it, but I did. Hey, he's a fun guy, that guy.
Yeah. Definitely, that whole interview was just a fun conversation. But my take, I wanted to hear your take on it, but my take was like, I'm like, oh, wow, this is a different league. Like, Tesla's doing something far more aggressive, far more ambitious right now, at least. It seems like Comma is taking this more safer, let's do lane keeping and let's target the aftermarket kind of market, you know, people with add-ons, right? And so their whole thing is they're not necessarily competing with Tesla, or they're not even competing with Mobileye per se. They're kind of have an open feel for themselves. But it seems like, you know, with this whole end-to-end learning, let's say with reinforcement learning, it's like, I mean, I get it how, like, if you have enough data and all this stuff and you can evaluate the performance, let's say, of that data, then it could work. But it seems like these corner cases, these extreme corner cases that, let's say, I'm experiencing at times when I drive as well, they just seem to be like such corner cases, or just, I don't know how, first, how reproducible they are, like in real life. And the second, like how to really have the amount of data to evaluate it, you know, accurately enough where you can skip this whole kind of tedious perception layer where you have to, you know, label and understand every object in the screen. It just seems to me that Tesla's approach makes more sense. Like, you know, like when it's more open-ended, like a world of driving, if it's a video game, I understand, like, end-to-end, you know, do reinforcement learning. You've got the rules, you know, the neural nets are rewarded by the score, and you can just repeat this a billion times, and the neural nets will figure out a way to get higher scores.
Why can't you just use MooZero?
yeah, exactly. I'm thinking
to solve the whole thing.
Yeah, you could. But with driving, it seems like much more, you know, challenging problem.
Nobody can do that right now. Yeah. With I wanted to explain something. Yeah. It's a way of thinking about what neural networks do that I think is helpful to try to understand the trade-offs between what Comma is trying to do and what Tesla is doing, right? So, you know, as an animal, as a human being, you're born and you have this genetic endowment that basically encourages your brain to form in particular ways. Like, for instance, your visual cortex is connected to your eyes, right? It's not like you're born and your eyes are connected to every part of your brain and it figures out what part of the brain is the right part to connect to. I mean, there's some things that you're just endowed with. Your visual cortex has an interconnect structure for the neurons, which is different from most of the rest. Most of your brain is pretty free form. Your neocortex. When I say your brain, I'm talking about the neocortex right now, the modern part of the brain. It's pretty free form and it's amazingly flexible. Your visual cortex, however, is constrained to a certain type of structure, which is predisposed to understand what the eyes see as essentially a two-dimensional plane of pixels coming in. I'm going to use the word pixel, even though that's a weird construct for an eye, where relationships of adjacent pixels are more important than relationships of distant pixels, right? That's just a constraint that's wired into your brain. Like in your visual cortex, when you're born, it forms these extremely localized layered connections in your visual cortex that are highly predisposed to discovering that what it's looking at is a two-dimensional plane of, it's an image that comes in, right? Your brain, it's not completely flexible. Okay, neural networks, they don't have any genetic endowment by nature, right? Like, I could just connect, you know, I can just have tons of neurons in bunches of layers and they interconnect, and it wouldn't necessarily have any predisposition to understanding an image is an image, right? It might have to try every different possible interpretation before it discovers image when it gets this kind of way. Now, convolutional neural networks, we actually do the same trick that the visual cortex does. We do these small two-dimensional convolutions in the input, and that predisposes the network to understand this is an image, right? So if I take a two-dimensional convolutional neural network that's two-dimensional and I try to feed languages into it as a language model, its performance isn't going to be very good. And similarly, when I take a one-dimensional People have done this recently, incidentally, and it happens to work much better than anybody thought it would. But if I don't have, if I don't include in the way data is introduced to the neural network, when it's an image, some aspect of its structure that predisposes the neural network to discovering that it's two-dimensional data, it won't start with the presumption that it's two-dimensional data, and it will take forever to figure out that it's two-dimensional data. Now, there are lots of other things about neural networks. I mean, I'm just talking about the most fundamental thing about an image is it's a two-dimensional set of pixels, right? An image, when we, an image from a camera is a two-dimensional, it's a two-dimensional image that looks into a three-dimensional world. So it's the projection of a three-dimensional world onto a two-dimensional surface, okay? The neural network has to figure this out. And it's really, really, really hard. Now, there are ways that you can try to structure the structure. Like you can try 3D convolutions, for instance. People have done this too. And 3D convolutions, they have baked into them the fundamental understanding that the world is three-dimensional, because I'm building the three-dimensional structure right into the way that the neural network. The problem is three-dimensional convolutions are, they're unbelievably inefficient and computationally intensive. So nobody actually does that. I mean, people have done, you know, toy experiments to basically show that it would work and it would have these properties. But one thing we know about it is it's so inefficient, you can't build a practical product using that. It would take thousands or millions of times more compute just to do the same things that we have right now. And we don't have the luxury of all that extra compute. So one of the things a neural network, and this is just one, right? There are many things a neural network, that a neural network that's driving a car, not only does it have to figure out like, oh, this is an image and these pixels associated together in clumps, they're patterns, they might be objects and that kind of stuff. It has to figure out it's a three-dimensional world. And it has to go beyond that to understanding constructs like, you know, there are objects in the world and there is space that the objects move through. And some space is good and some space is bad, you know, and it has to learn the rules of physics. Like objects are, they travel continuously. And so they don't, you know, instantly transition from one place. They don't instantly rotate. It has to learn all this kind of stuff. And, there are some things that we can tell the neural network that we can give it as part of its genetic endowment, its structure when we create it. But there's very, very few. And it turns out the two-dimensional nature of an image is one of the very few things that we can reliably tell a neural network. And it's got to figure everything else out. Okay, so how much thinking does it, how many different things does it have to work through before it stumbles onto the right set of models for how the world is actually structured? And it turns out that that's, I mean, we think in the ML space, we talk about the neural network is performing a search. It's searching through all the possible ways it could think about what you're giving it in order to come up with an approximation that gets it the right answer with the least computation and the most accuracy. So you can try to do a thing where you just put, you know, raw data in one end, and then you have this very complicated high-dimensional problem. Right. And the thing I get out the end is one simple output, like turn the steering wheel left. Like this is the ideal of end to end, right? Mm-hmm. Camera in one eye, turn the steering wheel on the other end. But in order to do that, you're relying on the network. Like I'm going to give it stuff and it's got to figure out, oh, the world is three dimensional and there's space and there are objects and there's inertia and there's gravity. And there are these things called pedestrians and some of them are assholes, you know, it's got to figure out all that stuff on its own. So, the amount of sort of samples that you have to run through the network before it figures all this out, because it's getting no guidance. The only thing you've told it is these are pixels, right? And it has to figure everything else about the world out. It doesn't get what, you know, as a human being, you're born and you have a predisposition to understand that objects exist and that kind of stuff. And the neural networks, they don't have that because we don't know how to give it to them right now. So there are various things that you can do to try to make it easier on the neural network. And one of the things that you can do is you can ask it, like, for instance, if I know that pedestrians are an important concept or drivable space is an important concept or that three-dimensional space is an important concept, what I can do is I can train my network and I can have the steering output coming, which is what CommAI wants. But I can also ask it other questions along the way. I can say, tell me where the pedestrians are. Here's a, you know, show me the pedestrian, show me the pedestrian, or show me the drivable space, all that kind of stuff, right? Now, at the end of the day, it may be that all you care about is whether it turns the steering wheel left or right. But the thing is, if I ask it about things that that I believe, as the designer of the system, are important things for the system to understand. I'm encouraging it to develop that concept quickly, right? Because I'm specifically asking it that concept. And once it's developed that concept, it can use it to more quickly get to the ability that I want it to have. So this is called, if you have a neural network and I'm putting my input in the bottom and I'm going through all these layers and I have my output from the top. Sometimes when you're training a network, what you do is you inject signal partway through the thing. So, you know, I have my driving stack and what Comma wants to do is get pixels in and have the steering wheel come out. But if from the sides, I were to do stuff like say, tell me about pedestrians, tell me about stop signs, tell me about drivable space, right? Tell me where this car is going. You know, I challenge it to do all these other things. I'm encouraging it directly to figure those things out. So it's not, so it doesn't consider solutions that don't include those. Now, sometimes that's bad. And, you know, George had said, he had this line that he brought up that he believes that there's no human understandable interface between perception and planning, right? And he's interpreting what Tesla is doing as building a perception layer and defining what that interface is, right? In other words, the interface shall be a list of all the pedestrians, a list of all the stop signs, a list of all the blah, 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 blah. And then you take that interface and you feed it into an out. And that's certainly a way that you can do it, but that is not actually what Tesla is doing. Actually, one of the things that I would have been interested to ask George is if he's actually ever seen the Tesla neural network, because I've seen them. Mm-hmm. And the stuff that comes out, they have all these outputs. They have the drivable space and they have the, they have the pedestrians and they have the moving objects and all that kind of stuff. But they also have this big vector that comes out, which is, that comes out of this network that just feeds into the upper layers. So in a sense, they're asking the car for all these things. And when they ship intermediate versions of the product, some of those are useful. Like that picture that you see in the mind of the computer thing, that's one of those out. They can take those outputs that they're asked, that they're challenging the network. Tell me about the cars. Tell me about the drivable space. Tell me about the stop signs. They're telling it all that kind of stuff. And when the network can do that, and it can do it reasonably well, it can show you that part of the perception layer. And that's a useful diagnostic, right? But that doesn't have to be the only thing that you feed to the planning layer. You can have just this crystallized chunk of knowledge that comes out of the neural network that goes up there. And the thing is, if you have trained the network to know about all of these things in the real world, it's a fairly simple thing for the neural network to include those concepts, to include that understanding of the world in what it passes to the planning layer. Now, if I don't do this stuff, if I don't ask it about all these intermediate products in between, the network has to try all the possible combinations. It has to consider all of these possibilities before it's able to single down onto, oh, you know, there's a thing in the world called a pedestrian. And that's something, you know, it's got a special kind of status and I need to have certain special behaviors when I do. And if it has to figure this out on its own, it's a more complicated problem. The search space of things that it has to consider before it can drill down on the things, on the most useful thing is just bigger. So in a sense, what Tesla is doing, what Andre is doing when he's challenging the Tesla perception network to understand all these things is he's prompting it the way you might prompt a kid, right? You don't turn a kid loose in the world and let it just figure out how to live in the world. You know, it goes through this area where, you know, you talk baby talk to it so it can learn language and you point things out and say, that's a cow and this is a car and don't cross the street in front of traffic, because kids learn it faster. They get to a functional level of capacity more quickly if they get guidance. So in a sense, what you could think of what Tesla is doing as providing this additional guidance to the car, to the neural network when it's training, so it takes less training and less data and less computation to get to the result that you want. Now, maybe Comma has a trick that nobody else has that they know about. I mean, George is a smart guy. Maybe they got it. I think it's really unlikely. Because they're a development organization, they're not a research organization. And it seems like that would be a pretty hard thing to do. Now, another possibility is that Comma has looked at the trajectory of improvement in AI technology, and they've said, well, you no, it's going to take us 7 years to get to this point. And we think that by the time we're ready to do it, somebody will have figured this out, or the computers will be big enough, or we'll have more data or whatnot. And that's what I think they're probably doing, is that they're gambling. I call it a gamble. You know, they think that the rate of progress in the fundamental and the fundamental techniques of artificial intelligence and the resources available to do this stuff is going to improve fast enough that by the time that they really need that technique, somebody will have figured out how to do it and they can do it. But right now you can't do it. And it's not clear that anybody is going to be able to do it soon. And it might not be doable. That's another possibility too. I mean, we don't have existence proofs, you know, just like, you know, babies that grow up in the dark don't learn anything. Like sophisticated systems in the real world, they get a certain amount of, they either get a high, like deer get a part of the genetic endowment of a deer is how to run, which is why they're born, they stand up and they can run, right? Babies, that's not it. It's a thing they have to get, that they have to figure out through a lot of experimentation and assistance and guidance.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, like as you describe it, I'm like, I understand the, before I was like, you know, like, it just makes sense for me, like Tessa's approach, where you break it down into like, and I think what makes sense now after your description is, I think George has this idea that Tessa's dividing it into two completely separate steps, which, you know, maybe right now intermediary they're doing right now, but like you parse the image and then you give this kind of like the objects or the classifications, like a different thing to the planning stack to work off of. But I've always understood it as Tesla is taking the image and is just maybe expounding the image, or I would say annotating the image, or maybe just giving a fuller, you know, intermediary kind of understanding steps of the image. But this image is going into the planning stack. Eventually this whole planning stack will be neural net based too. Eventually, like, it'll be kind of like the image coming in and the action coming out, you know, but in order to get there, it's like you're needing your neural nets to be able to highly accurately identify objects that don't necessarily pop up in the same way very often. Like, for example, in a game, the objects, like, you can just run it a billion times and pick up all the objects very easily. It seems like real world AI has this thing where it's like, you need this intermediate layer of trying to understand, perceive the world accurately, that purely just based, I don't know what's your take, but it doesn't seem like that we have the data.
It's a matter of how hard the problem is, right? Yeah. And what you need to solve it. I was thinking about this whole 2D, 3D thing for a long time. Like when I was first driving AP1 and I saw the hill cresting, it had this problem where, you know, occasionally you're driving it and the road goes over a hill. And from the car's perspective, you know, the lane lines, they go up and they just end, right? Because that's the crest of the hill. And then what does the car think is on the other side of that hill? It's not something that you can label in a 2D image. Somehow the car has to have a sense. Well, the road keeps going after the hill. Just because you can't see the lines doesn't mean there's no road, right? And so I thought a lot about this, like, how do you get this idea? How do you convey this idea that the neural network gets early on in its training, as in its attempts to understand the world, that there is a world beyond the crest of the hill. And there is there's very likely a road and lanes and that kind of stuff. And it has to make a guess. So which way is the road likely to go? Is it going to continue on the curve? That kind of stuff. And for a long time, you know, the neural network wasn't getting that. And then eventually Tesla, they did figure out how to train the network so that, like, it would see the mountains or the trees or the telephone poles. And it would be like, oh, yeah, the road goes to the right after it goes over the hill, the same way a human being does. The bird's eye view. So some guys at Google Brain did a thing. I want to say it was like 3 or 4 years ago. I was super excited when I saw this result. They did a thing where they took a neural network. It was pretty much, you know, it was a convolutional neural network. It was pretty dumb. And they gave it images and they made this toy world in the computer. It was very, very simple. Just had a couple of platonic shapes and rooms and some very simple patterns and that kind of stuff. But what they would do is they would show the neural network a picture of the scene inside this room from one angle. And they would tell the neural network, tell me what it looks like from this other angle. Like that was the essential. Now, this is all done in a computer. So the computer was randomly generating these rooms and it would ask questions from different angles and that kind of stuff. And it's a very interesting piece of research. Like, what does it take for a computer to just looking at images go, oh, this is a three-dimensional world. And I'm looking at it through a camera and it has this kind of spherical, you know, kind of shape to it. And there are objects and they occlude light. And, you know, it's got to figure out all these things. So that you can ask it, if I was standing to the right so I can see behind the tree, what would I see? And make those kinds of guesses. So they did this experiment and they showed that the computer could figure this stuff out, right? But what they discovered was, it can only do that if the world is really simple and if you have lots of computation and if you have zillions and zillions and zillions of examples. Now, that was given the techniques that they had at that time in the compute and all that kind of stuff. There's nothing to say that people won't come up with better techniques so that you could do that with the real world. Like if you wanted to try to do the same trick and do like photorealistic worlds in Unreal Engine or something like that, you can't do that today. Like people have looked at that. And this experiment, it doesn't work once the resolution gets high enough and the world gets complicated enough, because the possible things that the machine has to figure out when it's training, it just gets too large and it can't solve that problem. So an intermediate, thing that you could try to do instead in Unreal Engine is like, you know, label all the cars and label all the pedestrians and try to get the thing to understand it's a three-dimensional world and that kind of stuff to do this thing. But I had thought for a long time that an interesting possibility was to ask the neural network for the car, like when Tesla was training this neural network, what does it look like from the side? Well, they went with what does it look like from above, right? That's what the bird's eye view network is. It's like them saying, here's what I see. What would it look like from above? And you can only figure that out if you get that the world is three-dimensional. Like you have to figure out that the world is three-dimensional. And when I'm asking you this question, it prompts you to figure it out quickly. So you get that early. And then everything else that you train on after that can build on top of this. So I was super excited when I saw that they were doing camera fusion and then they were going to bird's eye view right away, because the feedback to that bird's eye view layer, it encourages the neural network to understand the world is three-dimensional. Like that is really fundamental. And it's something, I mean, the neural network doesn't know we're not at the quantum realm. It doesn't know we're not on a neutron star, right? And it doesn't know about time. It doesn't know any of these things, right? It has to learn all of that stuff from scratch. And you make the job simple through clever techniques where you don't allow it to consider options that are outside that, or you challenge it, you ask it questions that, you know, like a good teacher, that will guide it toward what you know is a useful set of models of reality that it can use. Mm-hmm. So this is how I interpret what Tesla is doing. Carpathy is doing something that is guaranteed to work, right? Yeah. It will work. And we don't know exactly how long it's going to take, but it's completely built upon techniques that are known to work in this regime.
Yeah.
George is positing a technique that it would be great if it works. I will be as excited as anybody, because man, if you can make that work, you know, the cleaning robots they're really close once you figure that out. Yeah. But right now nobody can do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, my take is George is going to have to do what Tesla is doing in some way. I mean, I think,
You can do a lot. It's, you know, people, the lane keeping thing that George is doing, like other people have done that end to end before. And there are self-driving car startups out there that are really focused on end to end. They're trying to figure out what's the least stuff. If you can do end to end, you save. All that data that Tesla is taking and all that labeling that they're doing and all that debugging and all that making this really complicated network with all of these thousands of different heads where you're injecting information into the network as you train it. Like that's a lot of work. It takes a lot of people and a lot of cleverness. And if you can figure out how to do it with just software and a big computer, then obviously that's a super attractive solution. And people are working hard on that. And they're making progress on it. But right now we don't know what it will take to make that work. And it might happen in a year and it might not happen for 10 years or 20 years. It might never happen. It might be that those constructs are just computationally infeasible with data that is at the resolution of the real world.
Yeah. I was reading a blog post by Andre Carpathy dated in 2016 or so, and it kind of details his thoughts on reinforcement learning. And I was actually encouraged because he was really deep into reinforcement learning back in 2016 at the cutting edge.
Yeah.
And it's not Tesla isn't doing
pixels. Is that what it was?
Yeah. He's not, they're not like,
that's an awesome blog.
Yeah. I mean, it's Tesla's approach, in my opinion, it's because he believes in the power of, reinforcement or end-to-end learning, that they are taking these steps to really, take these intermediate steps, or,
I would say Carpathy is, to the greatest extent possible, using supervised learning, because that is what is best understood. Mm-hmm. And they've started using, we had the conversation about pseudo LIDAR, right? Which pseudo LIDAR, it's a self-supervised learning technique that lets you use unlabeled data to learn about the three-dimensional, to learn about how to predict depth for images, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
It's a training technique. It's not an ability. It's a training technique. So he's using that self-supervised now because there's no other way to do it. You can't depth label images. It's too labor intensive, and there's no automated equipment that can depth label every pixel in an image. But with pseudo LIDAR, you can try to get there. But he's using the most conservative, most reliable, most well understood techniques what they're doing is very conservative from a neural networking standpoint. They're really focused on stuff they know works, and they're willing to put resources into, like, if it's going to take, 1,000 man years to label this data set, we're going to hire 1,000 people and they're going to work on it for a year, right? They're going to resource it, and they're not going to pray that a technique works. So even if neural networks never get any better, Carpathy's approach is going to work. It's just going to take time. And if neural network techniques get a lot better, it'll happen sooner, right?
Yeah.
But what Comma AI wants to do, it will not happen unless the techniques get a lot better. Now, they are going to get a lot better. How fast they get better in the specific way that Comma needs them to get better is still open to debate.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about, so we got these version changes. We have version 9 right now, which basically takes out radar, relying solely on vision. Elon has hinted to version 10, having some fundamental things they need to work on, and then 11. Like, I'm starting to think these versions are, they're signifying big changes. Like, for example, 8 to 9 is removing radar, going to vision. Do you think, what are the big changes you think that are ahead with version 10 and 11 that will lead to wide release? Like, for example, just off the top of my head.
One stack to rule them all.
Yeah, I mean, eventually that's where it ends up. But I mean,
the unified perception. Well, there are errors that you see. Mm-hmm. Like, you sent me some of the parking lot entry errors.
Yeah.
Like, that's a, the transition between parking lots and not parking lots. And I think one of the problems that you were having before when you were, with the GPS off air, part of the problem might've been that Tesla was looking at the GPS location saying, oh, he's in a parking lot, and running the parking lot neural network, right? Instead of the driving on the street neural network. Like, I don't know that that's what's happening. But it occurred to me, like, how do they choose the network that they're, because they've got these, they have a network for when you're in the parking lot, and they have another network for when you're driving down the street, and they have one for when you're at intersections, that kind of stuff. How do they know when to switch between the networks, or which one to listen to when they're driving? And, when I saw that error, that you're going, like, God, I wonder if they're using GPS to make that decision, right? But then you've got the thing, like, when you enter a parking lot, it's got to switch from one to the other. Well, where exactly is the entrance? Like, where do the rules of the road end and the rules of the parking lot start? There's kind of this vague zone in between. And so when the car makes that transition, there are the weird things that can happen when you do, because a parking lot is basically trained for when you're in a parking lot for sure, and you're just doing parking lot stuff. And the road one is trained for, like, when you're on a road and you're just doing road stuff. And the intermediate zone, where you're kind of in a road, but you're kind of in a parking lot, or you're making the transition between, and you have to switch rules as you go, that's a prime place to have problems, right? As you switch between those two modalities, because neither of the networks is necessarily especially good there. And you're switching networks right in the middle of that. There's all kinds of problems that can occur when you switch from one domain, one way of thinking about the problem you're trying to solve, to switching to another one. So to deal with that, you know, the elegant right way to deal with this is you have a single network and it can do roads and it can do parking lots and it can tell which one it's in by just looking at what's in it. Mm-hmm. And it knows about the transition between the two. So it knows how to behave as it's transitioning out of a road into a parking lot or vice versa. Like it, you know, that's something you get when you have one stack to rule them all.
Yeah.
But you don't get to tune your network for roads and tune your network for parking lots. You have to come up with a single network, you know, that can do it all. And that's a harder training challenge, right? Than that. It's easier to break the network apart and switch networks when you go as a quick and dirty way of getting going. But in the end, you have to have a singular network. So the question, like, I think Tesla will unify those networks as soon as they have demonstrated that they can train a single network that gives them acceptable performance across all those domains. And my guess is they just don't have it right now, which is why the cars are still driving around with 3, 4, 5 different networks in them.
Got it. Do you think version 10 or version 11 will unify those different networks?
That would require that I know something about how they're making progress on that unified thing.
And got it.
It's like, I used to look at the neural networks like a lot frequently because that was the best way that I felt like I had to understand how Tesla was making progress. And at some point, it started getting complicated. Like as the networks got more and more complicated and there were more moving parts, and as Tesla stopped doing things that I could look up in, you know, on archive in a paper, like for a long time, I could look at Tesla's networks and I could find the papers in archive that they had derived the structure from, right? And I could read that paper and I could know like what the performance characteristics of that network were and its training characteristics. But they move over time more and more to stuff that they have developed in-house for which I can find no outside information that tells me what's going on. So it's become more and more useful for me to like watch Andre's videos over time to try to understand what's going on. So I haven't been looking at the networks to see how they change. But one way to figure it out, and this is something I will look at, you know, the next time I bother to take a look at this stuff, is have they started putting a test version of the unified network out? Because we'll probably see it running in shadow mode for a while before it's ready, because you know, that's what you do. You'd put a shadow version of your unified network out there that was for the cars that were driving the split networks. And you would have the shadow unified network make all the same predictions and see how it was doing against the tuned networks.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Man, this stuff is like, I don't know. I mean, it seems so fascinating to me. Like the not just the goal, but like the steps toward it, how all these different people and companies have different approaches, different ideas. It also is fascinating to me about what this unleashes. You know, I was tweeting this morning, it's like Elon sets out to build electric cars, but then ends up trying to, you know, like add on, let's say autopilot or self-driving, but then goes into kind of this real world type of, you know, AI where you have to you have perception and planning in the real world, and now perhaps it segues into robotics in different ways. George Hotz, he had this interesting thing where he thinks it's AI goes from self-driving to cleaning and cooking robots to AGI. Do you see any validity to that, or what's your thoughts?
But okay, so if you're going to rank them in terms of difficulty or how soon they're going to happen, it's definitely games, self-driving cars, cleaning robots, AGI. We definitely don't get the cleaning robots until we've nailed the cars, because the cars is much easier than cleaning robots. Yeah. And the cleaning robots are a lot easier than AGI. Right. So that's the priority. And that was kind of what I took from George's cleaning robots is a fun way to talk about it. And cleaning is hard. Cleaning and cooking and doing a lot of the high manual dexterity, perceptual sophistication, you know, things in the real world. But, you know, we talked about delivering boxes, right? Which is just humanoid robots moving around in the real world. Like that's an unsolved problem today. And it relies on many of the same fundamental capabilities that a self-driving car has. It's just that the world that a humanoid robot occupies has a lot more variables and it's a lot more complicated than the world that cars occupy. Because, you know, the rules of the road are much more constrained than the rules of the sidewalk are, right? So yeah, I think that's, you know, it's a fun way to break down the problem. And those, they're probably about equidistant, right? Like in time, it takes so many years to get from games to self-driving cars, and so many years to get from self-driving cars to self-cleaning robots. And then so many, it's, and you know, although I'm fond of Jan LeCun's observation that AGI is kind of a misnomer, that there's no such thing as general intelligence, that humans are not general intelligences, which undoubtedly we are not general. So he questions, like, what is that thing you're calling AGI, which people sometimes think, you know, they do a quick and dirty definition of it is like, well, if I have an AI that can do everything a human can do and it can do it better, right, then that, that we call that. So like, maybe we should call that, you know, superhuman AI or whatever. Those are probably about equidistant. General intelligence, as LeCun points out, right, that's actually a harder problem because, you know, humans are pretty good at three dimensions plus time. Like, you know, we're, that's part of our genetic endowment, and we get that and we understand that about the world really well. But, you know, if you were going to be general, you know, 27 dimensions plus four dimensions of time, that would also be in your bailiwick, right? Because that's part of the general problem. And it's a lot harder to have, you know, to be able to essentially domain independent process anything. Almost, you know, everything that we build is specialized for the task that it does. So going general, it's almost hard to imagine what that would be.
For the first time, I was thinking this morning, I'm like, if Tesla, you know, really is so-called the leader in real-world AI, and let's say they demonstrate that even further in a couple of weeks with AI Day, then it, you can make the next logical kind of conclusion that maybe Tesla is in the leadership position to solving for the cooking, cleaning robots problem. But if Tesla, I mean, this is like a lot of assumptions, obviously, but if Tesla is, let's say, ends up solving the cooking, cleaning robots first and, you know, in the best way, would they be in the leadership position to solve AGI? Because right now it seems like everyone's discounting, you know, Tesla. I mean, Google, DeepMind, you have a, like, you have Facebook, you have a bunch of other, you know, AI companies, labs who are far ahead, it appears, you know, than Tesla in the road to solving AGI. But are those companies going to go through the route of cleaning, you know, and cooking robots? Are they really going to do 3D physical AI? And if they don't, will that hamper their chances to do AGI? I mean, do you need to go through the physical world first, you know, to do AGI? I mean, maybe there's a digital version of it, right? Where it's, you know, it's so-called super intelligence in the digital realm. But it seems like in order to have a real physical presence that interacts with humans, let's say appropriately in the physical world, you kind of have to go through that path of the physical to get there. And it seems like self-driving cars, cooking, cleaning robots, and then a super intelligent physical robot, you know, that is, can do as much as a human or even better, right, physically, is the end thing. And it seems like that could be a possibility. What do, have you thought about this at all? Like Tesla's chances of creating a super
There's this problem, long-standing debate in AI called the embodiment problem, where for a long, you know, since the beginning, there have been people who felt like, you know, embodiment, you know, was an, going to be a really important component of getting to of training intelligences to up to the level where they become very generalized. And other people, it's, for a long time, embodiment was kind of the dominant thing. Like people really believed that practitioners, it seems like the field went from believing that embodiment was important to getting to superhuman intelligence to right now, I would say it's kind of in the minority that, but it's hard to have the debate. There are a lot of people who really believe it's important. And, I've gone back and forth on the question myself about whether it's necessary, you know, over the years. I've stopped thinking about, I've tried to stop thinking about artificial intelligence in anthropomorphic terms. It makes it easier to explain, but I think it has the risk that that you'll miss really important things, because you know, a spider is pretty alien to a human being, and but it's nowhere near as alien as an artificial intelligence is. An artificial intelligence is just an utterly, utterly alien. It's something that literally wasn't born of this world. It was created, and you know, it's a really sophisticated thing that like that. So it's going to be unconstrained. You know, every sophisticated system in the world today grew up through competitive evolution, right? Because every, like, you know, all the really sophisticated systems that we see are based on life, and life is the result of an evolutionary process. And artificial intelligence, it might not be developed that way. And if you don't have evolution as a common constraint with the other sophisticated systems, there's going to be kind of a very large motivational, you know, and perceptual gap for creatures that get created in that fashion. And I think it's a little risky to over anthropomorphize these things, risky in the sense that you could miss something really important about that. I guess I've kind of run down a rat hole on that thing, but so I think Hassabis is, you know, it's a Hotz also brought up Demis Hassabis, right? Mm-hmm. So he's a good example of the school that doesn't believe embodiment is super important right now, as far as I can tell, anyway, from his public statements on the thing.
Yeah, he seems like deep mind.
But he's also not trying to make general intelligence. Yeah. He's trying to make very sophisticated, like AlphaFold is not general intelligence. Yeah. And a general intelligence that could do what AlphaFold does and also do what MooZero does and do, you know, all the other, you know, Clip and all the GAN stuff and all that kind of stuff, that would be weird. But, you know, his deep mind's motto is solve artificial intelligence and then use that to solve everything else. And that doesn't require you to solve it in one system, right? You can build lots of specialized systems for all the things. And that's going to be easier in a more direct path. And it seems to me to be what they're doing. And so instead of thinking of the end goal as, you know, what Minsky's Society of Mind, where we have to build all the different pieces and we have to get them working together, the pieces can be separate. You know, you know, that's one way to like avoid having it take over. Also,
that's right? True. Yeah. That's true.
Divide and conquer. Keep the computer's limbic system away from its frontal cortex, and you know that way we'll retain some control.
Exactly. Definitely. Hopeful, optimistic view. Definitely, James. I want to thank you for taking this time out and doing this live stream with me on super fascinating topics. It just gets more fascinating, I feel like, you know, the more we talk about this stuff.
The world was very different at the beginning of the steam age or the beginning of the electrical age. But like, what was it like for people back then? Because it's like, I try to think sometimes to put myself in a historical context of some other, you know, huge societal transition that where I know how it turned out because it's in the past, and try to imagine what it was like at the beginning. The one that I keep going back to is flight, right? The Wright brothers, right? Like what people at that time thought about how this was going to change the world and how the technology came into the world, and you know, to what extent could they have imagined where I'm pretty sure that the Wright brothers didn't think that, you know, there were going to be that the X-15 was going to be around in 50 years, right? That would have been just really hard to imagine. It wasn't even 50 years between, you know, humans in rocket planes leaving the atmosphere from the Wright brothers, like getting their glider down the hill at Kitty Hawk. And I think things move faster now, and AI is going to happen a lot quicker than that. And so like, if these are the Kitty Hawk moments, right? Or if we're at the stage right now where, you know, at the Curtis Flyer or whatnot, like what's the X-15 of AI, right? Or what's the moonshot, the real moonshot of the AI, things that would have been, I think, pretty hard to conceive of at the beginning of that age that happened within, you know, just a few decades.
Yeah,
really?
Definitely. For those, we've got about 1,400 people live right now at this moment, but let's do a interaction thing. Go ahead and in the live comments, go ahead and type where you're from or where you're watching this live stream from. It'd be fascinating to hear or to watch or to see, you know, the different cities and countries that people are at right now. I noticed my system is kind of like laggy right now during this live stream. I'm not sure why. I think the audio video is a little bit off sync. So I'm sorry about that for those who were having a hard time watching that. But yeah, definitely want to thank everyone for joining. We've got in 2 weeks, Tesla AI Day is coming, but James is on the road on the AI Day. So we'll try to catch up with James after AI Day, maybe even before once again. But yeah, definitely excited to hear about that. And then for those who are wanting kind of some extra homework, go ahead and you can watch the playlist, James Dama AI playlist on my channel. We've got over 20 videos to kind of get you a primer. Also, some people were asking, like, where do you start learning? You know, like, where's the starting point? What would you suggest in terms of starting to, if you're starting to learn about AI, self-driving, all this stuff, where would you suggest people to get started? Would it be a book or some videos or some podcasts or any ideas?
That's a pretty hard question. I mean, it's a hard question and an easy question. The easy answer to that is you go to Google and you start Googling for stuff, and then you watch the YouTube videos that are most interesting to you. When I started, I mean, it was after deep learning, I went back to after the ImageNet results, I went back, and the only thing that was available at the time was, you know, luckily we'd already gotten to the point where there were all these college courses where professors were, you know, streaming their college courses and you could watch that stuff. And I really don't recommend that approach at all. I know a lot of people suggest it, but it's pretty opaque, and there are so many people on YouTube right now who are breaking this stuff down and making it easy to understand. And because I don't actually watch a lot of their videos myself, I'm like, off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you who the list are, but I do run across those videos from time to time. There are a lot of people. So like, if you really don't know anything about it, find some people that are doing YouTube videos on the topic, and then figure out what you're interested in about that. The way you make progress in anything, learning anything big and complicated, is by maintaining your enthusiasm for the thing. So, you know, get into it as quickly as you can, find what you're excited about, and then try to find the people who are doing that stuff, because that'll lead you. Deep learning is actually really simple. Like the mechanics of it. I think Hott said that too, you know, it's linear algebra. Like, if you know calculus, you're ahead of the game, right? Linear algebra is the biggest part of it. And it's only the simplest, dumbest linear algebra. You need to know about computers, and you need to learn to program in Python. You know, there's a lot of basic stuff like that. But machine learning is really actually a very simple empirical experimental field today. It hasn't reached the kind of deep specialization for practitioners that a lot of other fields, you know, you want to get into metallurgy, you got to learn a lot more than, like, metallurgy is vastly harder than machine learning is, which is why there are millions of people. I mean, the world's gone from nobody was doing this to there are millions of people. And Kaggle has these competitions that, like, 100,000 people will do a machine learning Kaggle competition, right? Like, anybody can do this stuff. Like, don't, if you're looking at stuff and the impression that you're getting is it's too complicated, you're just looking at the wrong stuff. Go find some other stuff to look at. That's my advice.
Yeah. I mean, I would echo a lot of that. Like, for me, I kind of need context. I need to know, like, rather than the details first, I need to know why this is important. And so someone is asking on Twitter, like, where to start. I'm like, well, I would actually start with ImageNet 2012, understanding kind of like what people were doing to, you know, understand images before that, in terms of just, you know, hand coding rules versus this, you know, this different approach of creating a neural net, and what the first neural net type of attempts were, you know, to understand images and understand, like, the history, or just see, like, it's a story. It's not just the technical details, you know, that people might explain on a chalkboard, but it's a story unfolding where, it's like people were surprised that actually neural nets can beat, you know, hand coding. And it's...
Did you watch the AlphaGo documentary?
Not yet.
You gotta watch it.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's a great way to get like broad context. It doesn't go into the tech very much at all. There's just a little bit in there, but it's a fascinating story. It's a really good documentary. I really recommend it.
That's cool. Yeah, definitely. AlphaFold. I think DeepMind had a great kind of
I think it's video on that like it. Well. Netflix has it. Yeah. You can watch it for free on YouTube. Yeah. It's very easy to find that documentary.
Yeah, but I love that the giving the context, like, you know, why this is significant, because then you start getting that interest of like, oh, okay. Yeah. Like, you know, how does this really work? Yeah.
So that's what motivates you.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Like you like that there's a lot of context. A lot of people, different people are excited about different things. Yeah. Images is one category that you can get your hands dirty really quickly. TensorFlow.
Yeah.
They have all these really simple tutorials. They have all these things built in Colab notebooks. Like Google will actually, like, if you want to play around with TensorFlow in a Colab network, they will give you access to very sophisticated backend hardware through a web interface. And you can build your own model. You can write the code in Python and you can run it on hardware that they will let you use for free, which is you don't have to spend any money. If you've got a web browser, like you could do this from Bangladesh. If you're a kid with a laptop in Bangladesh, you can use spin up a Google GPU cluster and train a deep learning model if you want to build it yourself. And you don't need any resources to do it right now. All you need is time and interest and an ability to kind of self-guide
I'm working with a developer for my company who didn't really have any machine learning experience, but I had him go through this course from Fast AI. And it kind of really lays down how to quickly, you know, launch a neural net project. And we've been just the past 3 months just doing kind of prototype test projects on different data sets or different problems, just like fooling around, you know, and he's doing the work. We're brainstorming, chatting. I see the results. And it's kind of like an interesting way to understand like what are the use cases, you know, and what are the challenges? Like right now, one of the difficult problems is like data. We're finding it's difficult to get like mass amounts of valuable data that I won't say proprietary, but like stuff that can end up in like giving value to people, you know. It's like it's just a different appreciation when you're trying to build something, you know, that's valuable to the end user. That's another way. Just try building something, actually. Do something like a Fast AI course and actually try to build, you know, I don't know, a simple image classifier or something, you know, or just, I don't know, a simple tool for people, you know, to use, all the better. I want to go ahead and just briefly go through some of the cities or places people are watching, because I think it's kind of cool. Mm-hmm. So we have Hartford, Connecticut, Hawaii, Canada. We have London, Atlanta, Fort Collins, Germany. Awesome. Boise, Idaho, Japan. Australia, we've got San Diego, Cape Town, nice. Another Germany, Alberta, Norway, nice. Los Angeles, California, Austin, Chicago, Houston. We've got another Austin. We got Denmark, San Jose, awesome. I grew up in San Jose. New Jersey, London, Barcelona, San Francisco. Romania, Malaysia, lots of Germany here.
Actually, it's Chicago. Eclectic, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's remarkable.
Pretty crazy. We've got Netherlands, Amsterdam. We got a couple more UK folks, Melbourne, lots of Germany people. All right. The list goes on, but it's pretty awesome how in this new world.
Thanks for dialing in, everybody.
We have this
amazing.
Connection where we have, you know, over 1,000 people.
I had no idea that there were that many people that were interested in this.
It's not just they're interested, like they're people who are watching to the very end, you know, and and they will go and they will continue to research.
You know, the folks in Germany, they might have dozed off at their laptops. Pretty late there.
Awesome, man. Oh, we got India too. Nice. Cool. Awesome. Anyways, James, thanks for chatting, and we'll definitely catch up again. And yeah, thanks everyone for tuning in. We'll talk to you guys later. All right. Bye.